Pickaxe.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hello and welcome back to The Review of Death, a Doctor Who podcast, your home for Doctor Who news and reviews. I am Matthew Toffolo, and I'm joined, as ever, on his birthday. Well, it's not his birthday, it's
not
his
yet.
Birthday tomorrow.
It's my birthday tomorrow.
Billy Garrett John.
I'm basically 26 in mind.
Yeah. By the time this goes out, you will be 26.
I will be 26. Yeah. So direct all of your parcels and messages to York's Towers. No.
Batman.
speaking of parcels.
Oh, wow.
Here you go.
Well, blow my soul. Look at that.
I'm glad it was blowing your soul.
Yeah, there you are. Well, I don't know what the present is yet.
You're, that's true.
Let's have a look. Thank you. As is tradition.
Yes.
On the. Oh, wow. No way. That is really bloody cool. Thank you, mate. That is a really cool present. Oh. The most beautiful TARDIS console there is.
I know.
In POG form.
You've got to open it up because I want to see what it looks like.
Let's have a look.
Let's get that out of the way.
This is as much for Matt as it is for me.
Yeah. I'm living vicariously through you.
Audio listeners who have just had their ears assaulted by the sound of this packaging being ripped open.
Unless you like ASMR.
Unless you're
you
into
off.
That kind of thing. I am opening an absolutely beautiful Doctor Who figurine collection TV movie console TARDIS console from Hero Collector.
Yeah.
I've never, apart from the Agador, which I should have brought, really,
considering
talking about Curse of Peladon.
And I did try and find you another Curse of Peladon related figurine, but
I guess Alpha Centauri is quite hard to come by.
Yeah.
Everybody wants a bit of Alpha.
They do, don't they?
I think we might need some scissors. Or can I just rip things asunder with my bare hands?
You could have a go.
I can have a go, can't I? I can have a go.
Go on.
Oh, it's styrofoam as well. I think
it's
we might
be
need to
really,
cut this
really
for the audio
unpleasant
listeners.
Sounds. Go on, that's it.
Right, okay, I'm just going to put it over the front and get styrofoam absolutely everywhere. But it's not like we come into this office on a regular basis and there's things that have been on fire in here before we've got in.
True.
Let's have a looky at
but
this.
But polystyrene
thing.
Is no problem at all.
Carefully
wrapped
it's
in
very
tissue.
Carefully wrapped, beautifully.
Oh.
There's some more packaging for the mic rustlers who like it out there. Now, isn't
look
that,
at that
absolutely awesome?
Wow, that is nice.
Now, the detail on the controls as well.
Yeah.
That's really quite something.
Very nice. I mean, and the rotor as well.
The time rotor is lovely. You obviously want things to move on there.
Yeah.
But, do you know what? For the fact that this is going to be bought by a small number of people, really, even in the grand scheme of Doctor Who merch, that is a lovely
It's a nice
bit
piece.
Of gear.
Thank you,
mate.
I'm really impressed that they've done like the little lamp bit here as like a separate little bit that actually sticks out. You
exactly.
Know.
Now, and this is to scale with the...
With Agador. Yeah, so you can have the adventures of Agador and
my
Paul
McGann. My favourite adventure. Yeah. My favourite story never seen on screen. Get on that big finish. There's a 27
disc box. Well, Paul McGann has turned up on Peladon, hasn't he, in that Peladon box set?
He has. I'm interested and excited to listen to that because, you know, Peladon, as we'll get into, is one of the more interesting locales the Doctor's visited and one of the most sort of...
Oh, no, that was a really satisfying schlump.
Do you think?
Yeah.
God.
Or was that, did that cut through you?
That cut through me like a bloody knife. Right, I'll set this aside. Thank you, mate. That
No problem.
Really,
my pleasure.
Really,
happy birthday.
Thank you very much.
And you get a little magazine as well.
And I get a little magazine with Paul McGann on the front. It doesn't get better than that.
Yeah.
I wonder if the pages are stuck together already. We went to as part of a birthday present as well,
yeah,
we went to see the Dalek movies.
We did.
In the cinema.
My God, I never thought we'd actually get to see them in the cinema properly.
Have you never, you've never seen them on a big screen before?
Well, I saw Dalek Invasion of Earth with you. Oh no, did you go? I don't think you went, did you?
No,
that
no,
was
no.
with our or Doctor Who.
And that was
meetup.
Just like a DVD copy that somebody
brought
along.
Yeah, Blu-ray in a back of a pub. But mm-hmm. it was nice. It was a nice little screen. And it was good fun, but this was obviously on a much bigger screen,
exactly.
4K restoration.
The brand new restoration of it. I had seen, I don't know if it was like a print that had been lying around or if it was being played off a disc, but I saw Dalek Invasion of Earth maybe nearly 7-8 years ago now at the Curzon Cinema in Clevedon. And it was great. I think there was a Doctor Who episode on that night, actually. It was a Matt Smith finale.
Oh, right.
Maybe like a mid-season finale. But it was great seeing it on the big screen, but seeing this restoration of the film. And if you haven't got the Blu-ray disc yet, go out and get it. I mean, I'm sure everybody has the Dalek movies in some form.
Yeah.
But as somebody who owns those sets, would you say they're worth getting?
Well, I haven't actually put any of the discs in. So,
do they have any special features?
There's a new documentary.
Is there?
On one. And I think it's Marcus Hearn, editor of DWM, is behind that one. So yes, there's a new documentary. I think there might be another documentary perhaps about the restoration of putting it into 4K.
Is Dalek Mania on there?
Dalek Mania is on there.
Cool. I haven't seen that for years. I have that as a separate VHS somewhere.
Yes, so do we. Yeah. We've got an actual, this was Jonathan's, it was a Dalek Mania box set. And it was like a board. It looked like a board game. It's in like a big box. I'm sure some people have got this.
Somebody's out there going, "Oh my god, I had that!"
Yeah. So, and we've still got the whole thing. And it's like a board game. And you open it up, and then you've got the VHS, and it came with the posters for both films. I don't know if it came with some other stuff, but it was weird. It was just like this very lavishly packaged thing.
Yeah. And is that how you would have watched the Dalek movies initially? Was it the first time you saw them?
The first time I saw them was on VHS.
Same. Everybody, when you did the episode with Ellie when I wasn't here, talking about how people got into Doctor Who, a lot of people said the Dalek movies.
Yeah.
Like a surprising volume of people were like, oh, it was on Channel 5 or Channel 4 or whatever, and I just caught it. And I think even Mr. TARDIS has said in one of his videos that one of his earliest memories is that scene in Invasion Earth when the Daleks turn up at the doorstep of the old hags,
and they
sell them out. It's just that is a great scene.
That is a good scene. She's really good. The young one. She's a real bitch.
Yeah.
I was watching it in 4K, thinking even in 4K, you're horrible.
Yeah,
Carol.
I mean she
plays it well.
Pulling lots of facial expressions. Yeah. She's doing lots of it's like Shifty Eye Dog in The Simpsons.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and the old lady.
Eileen Way,
she'd been in Doctor Who.
She's been in two Doctor Who's.
Is she in the first story?
She's in An Unearthly Child
as the old woman.
You killed the old woman.
I recognised her straight away.
Yeah. And then she plays another old woman in Creature from the Pit.
Indeed.
Yeah.
I mean, is that a diss? When you just constantly get cast as old haggard crones.
You've got to think, she was playing an old woman in 1963.
Yeah.
And then she was playing an old woman.
She's probably 35 then.
Yeah, she probably was. And then she was playing an old woman in 1980 or 79.
Do you reckon overnight she just went, oh God.
It's just happened.
I can only do those jobs
now. Yeah. We've been typecast.
God, before Maybelline and all that. Yeah. All the skin de-aging things you can get. So it was wonderful to see the films. Both back to back.
Yeah.
It didn't seem like, I was thinking, God, I've never seen movies back to back before.
Nor have I.
And I thought this might take a while.
Yeah.
And it did in parts, but in one movie in particular.
In the first one.
So, we'll talk about, historically, have you always preferred the second movie or the first movie?
Historically, I have always preferred the first one.
Yeah.
And I think, I was thinking about this, I think it's partly because that is the one that we had as a proper home video release, the other one we had taped off TV. So I think perhaps I watched that one more and therefore I favoured that one more.
Yeah.
But then again, I loved all that stuff in the second one with like the bridge falling down on top of the TARDIS and stuff. I used to recreate that with my Daypol figures all the time.
I was going to say, and we'll get on to another bit of Daypol recreation, but there are certain moments in this where I'm just like, I definitely put Jenga blocks out on the floor and I have my TARDIS landing there and they walk into Dalek control and they all emerge out of the shadows, you know, just... It taps into that imaginary, because it's fantasy. It feels more like fantasy, that first movie, than the second.
Yeah.
And I think it feels more, because it's super colourful, it feels like The Wizard of Oz.
That's it. You know? I think that's what always appealed. Like, when you see the two, especially back to back, one feels very grey compared to the other.
I mean, every shot in that first movie is just sumptuous, and especially in 4K.
Yeah.
Like, it's all studio bound.
Yeah, it's
mad. And it looks great. Yeah. Like, the forest looks amazing.
The forest looks fantastic.
The Dalek City.
That looks amazing. The map paintings for when they're climbing up the mountain. There's that wonderful shot of Ian when they're walking from the stream, and you've got the moon behind them.
Yeah.
And it's like, wow, this is like 1965. And that looks amazing. You could put that on TV now, and that would look brilliant.
Definitely.
It was so beautiful.
There are some elements of production design in this movie that don't quite work.
Yeah, Jonathan laughed at the Christmas wrapping paper stuck to the walls of the Cardinals of Skaro.
It's so alien though, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it's like, well, of course they have.
It's just Skarosian art.
Yeah, or maybe it's like recycled cases. Yeah. We're trying to protect the environment on Skaro. We've had a huge atomic war that has decimated the planet. The last thing we want to do is start reusing, is using non-renewable materials. So we just take some Dalekanium and twist it and put it on the walls. It's great. But the TARDIS from the outside.
Fantastic.
Beautiful. I mean, you have
I have one
that model in your garden. But the interior of the TARDIS.
Shit as hell.
Now, and because it carries over into the second movie.
Yeah.
That bizarre lever.
Yeah.
What is that about? Because to me, it kind of looks like they've gone, well, obviously you pilot a spaceship.
Yeah.
So it's got like handles like on an F1 car. That you'd expect you go like that to steer it, but you just rock it back and forth.
It's weird.
It's very odd.
I'm sure someone out there knows exactly what sort of a mechanism that is.
Yeah, it looks like something used in the railways. To,
that's it.
Change the lines and stuff.
But it is weird, and that is the one part of the production that always lets it down when you sort of think, you know, this is supposed to be the TV show, but bigger and better, and then that just doesn't work. Because it is just like someone's gone, we'll chuck some drapes up and some blinky lights and some wires.
It has got an element of some mad boffin has put it together.
Yeah.
It doesn't look like it's grown.
No.
Or it's all uniform and that's what the ships look like
when
they're built.
It doesn't feel like an alien spaceship.
It does feel like there's a kettle that they use as the the HADs or whatever. All that sort of stuff.
And no noise, the noise of the TARDIS.
Yeah.
Just a little.
But sound effect I'd never noticed before.
Yeah.
One from the show gets used in Dalek Invasion of Earth.
Yes, it's the fault locator sound.
Mm-hmm. You hear it on the Dalek ship.
Yeah.
When Bernard Cribbins and Louise, sorry, I don't know the actor's name, are wandering around the Dalek ship and hiding away.
I said to you in the cinema when Louise was introduced, I was like, Christ, Doctor Who's kids are just like, oh, fuck. Can we just give them the grandkids for the weekend? Oh, and your niece, go on.
Maybe that's their way of trying to get rid of them.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a burden. Look, it's the 60s. Living is difficult.
Yeah.
If they disappear on some unknown planet, we can just dob granddad in it. He's mad.
Yeah.
You know, nobody will think otherwise. But from every other production standpoint, that first movie works.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, the Daleks, first and foremost.
Stunning.
They look beautiful.
Yeah.
That blue fender in my head, that shot where they're trying to get it onto the cape to insulate it from the floor, that fender is just so, it looks so good.
Yeah.
It's everything about this film looks cool. And especially, as we noticed with the 4K restoration compared to the second movie, the props, the Dalek props in the second movie look really tatty.
They do. It feels like, I think the second one feels closer to TV Doctor Who in that way, because you start looking at the Daleks and going, ooh.
And more obviously a studio, when they have to use a studio for the exteriors, it looks more obviously like a TV, the film studio, soundstage.
But yeah, I mean, the gold Dalek, we were like, God, you can see the handprints on it and all the smears.
It almost looks like it's oxidized or something, like it's supposed to be shiny like the rest of them.
Yeah.
That black Dalek still looks great.
Yeah. The red one even didn't look quite so pristine.
No.
I guess they've all been painted, repainted and stuff. Like, you know, they've been loaned out to school fates.
The silver ones are closer to the TV colours.
Yeah.
And they've got the solar slats.
Yeah.
And I think that doesn't break up the look of it. Like, when you look at with the gold bands and the silver on the first
and the
machines.
Blue heads.
Yeah, it just all looks really broken up and really nicely. And in my head, I know it's obviously something they probably didn't even think about, but the flame torch Dalek with its blue neck rings, you think, is that a hierarchy thing? Is that colour, does that denote it's a service?
As far as I'm concerned, it's a hierarchy thing now.
Absolutely.
Never noticed it before in all the years.
No. But anyway, that first movie is just great.
It's great. I'm going to actually come out and say something quite controversial now.
Go on.
Which will probably come to us as a surprise to everybody. There may be pitchforks and people with torches hanging outside the office. I really don't like the first two Dalek stories.
No.
Do you not like them either?
I like Dalek Invasion of Earth.
Yeah.
I think that coming after the Daleks feels like a good length because it takes place over it's like the Keys of Marinus. It like goes all over the place.
That's true. Yeah.
But that first Dalek movie, when you watch it after watching the TV version, that's the definitive version of that story.
And I think this is the problem. I watched the films first before seeing those stories. And I think once you've seen the films and then you go back to those long drawn out versions, you do think, crike, this is slow.
The last portion of Doctor Who Night, I think, showed the last two episodes of the Daleks glued together.
Yeah.
So in my head, all of that stuff still runs the same quality-wise when they're with the Thals in the caves and they're trying to get and they're jumping the ravine and all that sort of stuff. Although a big change is that there's a death in the TV version
that
doesn't happen in the...
I mean,
they're all called Anadon and...
Aladon, is it?
Aladon is the... I mean, Peladon.
Yeah, oh my God.
Agador, Islier. We're just going to get very confused.
Yeah. The one who cuts the rope.
Yeah, the one who cuts the rope.
The
cowardly
one. Dies
in the TV one and then survives in the movie.
Yeah. What do you prefer?
It's very bleak. But then again... Lots of people die in the TV version.
Like, yeah,
you know, but the movie one is a much more sanitized.
It is, isn't
product.
It? Do any other than the main guy, the first one, is that Aladon?
The one that gets
blasted
when he comes for the food.
Yeah,
I mean, there's a couple of Thals that probably bite.
Or is Aladon?
Oh, they
the
fall
main
into
one.
the Daleks when they open the.
Oh yeah, into the
mountain.
Oh yeah, that's true.
They fall into that.
But yeah, it does feel like there's a lot more people getting killed in the TV version. But yeah, the TV one, you know, jumping across that ravine, that is like 23 minutes.
Yeah.
That's like a whole episode of just trying to get across a gap that is no further than from this sofa to that camera.
Yeah.
And it is just, oh.
It does take forever.
It takes forever.
Yeah.
And I mean, I can appreciate the stories as the first Dalek story and all that kind of thing. But I do think they can be deathly dull. The first couple of episodes are great, and then it just, it really does start to drag. And then obviously the film version, it just whistles through. Well, it sort of whistles through it.
We'll get onto that. But continuing what we're saying now, compared to the Dalek Invasion TV and the movie one, where do you sit with that?
Oh, I'd still rather watch the film.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Again, it's just pacier. Mm. Like I think, you know, with the Daleks, the stuff that is done better is... I think the Daleks are creepier.
Mm.
They're more manipulative and a bit more spooky. And I think all that stuff when the Daleks take the drugs, that is shot really well. Mm. All the perspective stuff. You sort of miss it really in the film version. It's just on a screen and they're like, oh, they're
going mental.
They're tripping.
Yeah.
but yeah, Invasion of Earth is just a lot. It whistles along again.
Mm.
You don't have all that stuff in the sewers with the crocodile.
That's true. I think in terms of the characters, I think that the subterfuge and the kind of resistance thing is better in the TV version.
Very much so.
And I think that the TV version also gives you more a sense of scale as they travel.
Mm.
Because all you really see is, you know, up to Bedfordshire on the map.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's kind of it.
Yeah.
And the streets all kind of look the same when they try to get to Watford and all that sort of stuff. It's all very much done within a mile radius of the studio.
It is, isn't it? It's amazing, really, when you think that the TV version gets all those wonderful shots of Trafalgar Square and on the bridge,
the
and they don't do it for the film, which would have looked amazing
exactly.
in colour.
Oh, my word.
Fantastic.
Can you imagine? And they wouldn't have been able to maybe shut some stuff down. I know the BBC is basically a civil service.
Yeah.
And they can pretty much do whatever they want at that point. But, Yeah, like you it could would, have really.
It would have looked amazing, especially with the saucer. The Dalek saucer looks fantastic. That's a great model.
I also think production design wise, I mean, we said this in the cinema, and it's not too dissimilar to the TV version, but it does feel like 2150 AD. The Daleks invaded in 1966,
yes.
And nothing is really progressing. Everybody's dressed the same, all the same cars out in the street. There's no attempt to really make it more sci-fi.
No, not at all.
And even in the TV version, didn't they superimpose some stuff over shot, or is that on the DVD? In my head, there's in the original
they
one,
They add something extra to Battersea Power Station.
Another
but I think
pylon
Ian mentions it.
Yeah.
He says that, they've got rid of something or they've added something. I can't remember. Yeah, I think, you know, especially watching it yesterday, I did think all those scenes where the Resistance are, like, building their tools and, you know, the guy in the wheelchairs, Dortmund's going, oh, you know, clean that rifle, grease that rifle or whatever. You do feel like I can really see where people got the sense of, oh, God, you know, we've just come out of the Second World War.
Yeah.
And, you know, all those memories flooding back, people hiding in the shelters and stuff. You really get that sort of wartime feel.
It's really well lit.
So I can really see why those stories fed into the zeitgeist at the time.
Definitely.
We
were going to go on just then to talk about the one real big problem with the first Dalek movie.
Right.
Which is the Daleks talk like this and don't speed up at any point.
Yeah.
And it's really annoying.
It is very
long
annoying.
Extended scenes of Dalek dialogue.
Yeah.
And I think it's because, and you don't see this in the second movie, they've obviously got the indicator settings on that flash, because to be honest, it does fill out the scene. And when they're flashing out of sequence, it does look kind of cool.
Yeah.
But when there's other Daleks talking in shot and they've just put the indicator lights on, they're obviously dub it, like, the most obvious one is when the black Dalek goes into the cell for the first time.
Yeah.
Which one of you will go outside the city?
Yeah.
I think they just didn't get that they're supposed to be a bit more chatty.
Yeah.
Or that somebody off screen is reading a script.
Yeah.
And they're talking like a robot, not like a Dalek.
Yeah.
It's not David Graham in the room.
No.
Directing the lights.
Yeah. It's a real shame. And I think, I don't know, I mean, it's still a little bit like that in Dalek Invasion of Earth.
It's
nowhere near as bad. And I do think they may have potentially cut down on the number of scenes where the Daleks are just chatting.
Yeah.
Probably for that very reason, because it is just so laboured.
You get a really quick scene in the cell.
Yeah.
And then you're back out talking to the Daleks.
Yeah.
And Johnny was hilarious watching it in the cinema. He was going, why is everybody laughing? It's not funny. Yeah. They're not saying anything, but, well, tell me what they said that's funny. And it was because every single time a Dalek appeared on screen and the red Dalek glides in, you think, oh, for fuck's sake, here we go again.
Yeah.
And they're just going to have a long old natter. Oh, don't mind us. Don't mind us sitting here not being entertained, watching all these Daleks gliding around in the background.
Yeah.
But then it looks so good.
Yeah.
You don't really care. No.
Yeah. And I think watching it, I was like, I don't think the Daleks have ever looked as good.
Or been operated as well. Except for the new series where you've got like a dedicated team.
Yeah.
I know you had John Scott Martin and Cy Town and Murphy Grumbar and all that back in the day. But Robert Jewell, absolute MVP of Dalek operating. Like he can spin on a dime.
Yeah, yeah.
He keeps it animated. He keeps it, you know. There's a great shot in that second movie where all the control panels are exploding.
Yes.
And it spins around to camera.
Yeah.
And it just looks amazing. For beauty shots of Daleks,
you
only need to watch that movie.
Yeah, very
just
much so.
Looks so cool.
I did wince, and I wince every time, but it felt even worse in 4K when the two Daleks go down the pit and they get smashed to smithereens. The lights come off and the ice stalk smashes.
Yeah.
And every time I was just sort of went, oh no.
It's rough looking at it.
Yeah.
So the second movie, historically, I've always thought the first movie's better. I can concede now, watching it on a big screen in the best quality I'll ever see it in, that it is, by most metrics, technically, a better film.
Yes.
But when you come immediately to this movie from Doctor Who and the Daleks, it looks so washed out.
It does.
And I know it's supposed to have that apocalyptic feel to it.
Yeah.
But sticking a Sugar Puffs poster in the background isn't going to help.
No. I think just the Daleks, I think if the Daleks look the same as they did in the first film, it might have just... And I think even the control room and stuff is all sort of green and, again, is drab colours, neutral colours.
There's bits of the saucer that look like the city from the first movie.
Yeah.
And there's obviously been a decision to move that continuity design over.
Yeah.
But as soon as they get to the mine workings,
yeah,
as cool as that set is...
Where it's a fantastic set.
I mean, how terrifying must it have been for those Dalek
Every
operators going
see,
down those ramps and...
Yeah.
Christ. I mean, it's like bumper cars, but without the health insurance, I'd imagine.
If one went... Oh.
And into that pit as well.
Oh, Jesus. You just don't want to think about it.
But again, the Dalek operator, isn't that a great? I think one of the black ones or the red ones comes down the ramp and it turns and it just parks itself in the archway of the control room. And you just think, good God, how much practice have you had?
Yeah.
You nerds. It's great.
It's amazing. It's really amazing. But it's a better film. It feels shorter than the first one.
Yeah, it does crack along a bit.
It cracks along very quickly. But I do think it is probably the best way to watch those first two Dalek stories.
100%.
Yeah.
Especially the first movie.
Yeah.
The first movie's great.
Yeah.
And it's not as laboured as the TV version.
Yeah. What about the Thals? The Thals are visually very different from the TV version.
They are. And obviously, I mean, it gets a laugh.
It does get a laugh.
When you pan up to Aladdin. And
it was quite funny because it was there was a gay pride event at the Downs
the day before.
And I thought they'd just all traipsed down to Scarrow. Mm.
They're great outfits, though. I mean, you look at it and you go, that is 60s sci-fi.
It really is.
And, it's so ridiculous.
You can think that these people are like, I've trained at RADA. And what have they done? They've waxed my chest.
There are a couple of them that look like they couldn't. They're just like, oh, what am I doing? Especially the party that go, I know they're supposed to look a bit miserable because they're heading to the Dalek City to certain doom.
Yeah.
But there's a couple of them that are pretty like, straight faced and I'm not enjoying this at all.
Yeah.
The Daleks, the dislike for the unlike, that great line, if they think we're monsters, what must they be like?
Yeah.
It kind of, they play off each other well as a concept and visually. I think they're good. Kind of opposition for each other.
And the nice moment with the Dalek claw under the...
Yeah, indeed. And wonderful that there was a kid sat in front of us who got so scared halfway through the movie that he left with his mum and never came back.
Yeah, and she potentially had COVID because she was coughing
a mad thing, yeah.
Yeah.
But, I mean, great, like, for the colourful, silly Disney version of Doctor Who on the big screen,
it scared that kid enough.
Yeah. And it was just the Daleks.
Yeah.
It was the Daleks and it was the promise that they were going into something dangerous and something dangerous was about to happen. And that kid was really not enjoying
it. Did you hear what he said to his mum at one point? He said, there's nowhere to hide.
Oh, yes.
And he was like, oh, bless him.
Brilliant.
Bless that little boy.
Terrify the youngsters. Why not? Well, on that subject matter, I've got something quite cool here to share with you. Right? Now, this was posted, I didn't find this, this was posted on Twitter, but I didn't see many people retweeting it. I have got the examiner's report from the British Board of Film Classification for Doctor Who and the Daleks.
Okay.
So there's a big spiel which basically describes the movie, and then there's a kind of summary, and then the person goes through bit by bit which sections they think need cutting.
Yeah.
So they say, I think most children in this country are now familiar with Doctor Who. I do not look at him much myself and do not know whether these particular adventures are new or old. I rather fancy that Ian, played by Roy Castle, is allotted more comedy than his counterpart in the TV serial, the bits of which that I have seen I thought more frightening than the present film script. Now, what do you think of Roy Castle in the film?
He's good fun.
Compared to old Bernie Cribbins.
Ooh. I do prefer Tom, I think.
Yeah. Roy Castle feels like the stunt casting in the film.
Yes.
Like, he's the only one that's in a different movie.
Yeah. Everything he does is a joke.
And a pratfall. Yeah.
Whereas I think Bernard knows when to do something humorous and when to be serious.
To play it serious. Yeah. Totally. Absolutely. I also believe this is the case for which... which seems to be intended would be a help rather than a hindrance in making the story fit for younger children. So they basically play up Ian being more of a Joker. Of course, we cannot say with any certainty till we see the film, as the treatment is really what matters. So basically saying it's a U. It should be a U.
Yeah.
And then beat by beat, he basically explains that there's too much screaming.
Right.
Barbara screams at a mouse. My only objection to this is that, as I've said, there are too many screams. So this must be an early version of the script.
Wow, yeah, yeah.
So he basically goes on and says, too much screaming. The fire guns, which they're supposed to shoot fire.
Yeah.
Obviously that turns into like CO2, which I think looks fine.
Yeah, yeah.
Saying, let's not do the fire because that will be too frightening.
I was thinking of this in the cinema. Mm. First of all, you know, how would you do that? That would just be far too dangerous anyway. And every time they were carrying those torches in the caves, and they would pass one to Barbara, I thought she's got so much hairspray on her head.
Oh, she's
going
to
go up. Like,
her haircut was something else.
It really was, wasn't it?
It was incredible. Now, at the end here, so they've obviously gone through the whole story, just complaints about screams and fire.
Yeah.
And too many Daleks burning, and the green claw maybe being a bit too creepy.
Right.
There's also supposed to be glowing eyes in the water
when
they go and look for water.
Because they do it in the TV show, don't they? Yep. They have a creature.
Now, this is interesting. This is the last note. Ferocious caveman worth a caution on treatment.
Ooh.
Which I think suggests that the next adventure, they were, because at the end, Ian opens the doors to the TARDIS, and they see the Roman legion coming towards them or something.
In a really weird perspective, though, like really high up.
In my head as a kid, I was like, oh, so the next one is Planet of Giants, but in the Romans. Romans times. That they may be menaced by a caveman at the end of the movie, and that's a little kind of reference to an unearthly child.
Oh.
So some early draft of the film out there probably has that little moment in there.
Very interesting.
Very cool.
That's very cool.
So on the whole, the Dalek movies.
Oh, they're great fun. What do we think of Peter Cushing? We haven't mentioned Peter Cushing.
Do you know, it's difficult because he's not playing the Doctor. And
No.
In the second movie, he's much better.
He's more Doctor, isn't
because
he?
Because Susan basically carries that first movie in terms of being proactive and putting in the legwork you'd expect from the Doctor in terms of solving things and figuring things out. He's a great actor.
Mm.
His eyebrows are very distracting in that first movie.
Yeah.
Which we realised were very swiftly removed. Somebody took... So you can thread those, you know.
Yeah.
Between films, Barbara and Susan took him out to his local eye place.
Yeah.
Eyebrow place. But he's a grand actor.
Mm.
As chummy human Doctor Who, he's great.
Yeah.
And obviously these aren't canonical.
Mm.
They fit in a different continuity. But it's difficult not to compare him to the TV versions.
Yeah.
He's a bit too chummy.
Yeah.
There's no edge to him.
Yeah, that's true.
Even when he says, look, there was nothing wrong with the fluid link, I just wanted to have a look at the city.
Yeah.
It's kind of, all right, Grandad.
Yeah, it is, isn't it?
You know?
You don't get, because in the proper story, you think, wow, what a bastard, don't you, when you think that of the Doctor.
I think he's playing older in the first movie.
Yeah, he doesn't feel quite so doddery, does he, in the second one?
Yeah.
He's a bit more on it.
I mean, there's radiation sickness to account for that, but,
true.
You know, when he's running around the warehouse with Tom.
Yeah.
And he's in the gimp suit, the rubber band gimp suit, which got a laugh when he walked in as well.
He wears it over his clothes.
I know. He must be baking underneath that thing.
In a pretty PVC suit.
And then he's running all over the place and there's fire and shit. The stunts in that second movie are really good.
Yeah.
That bit where Thompson runs over the rooftops.
Yeah.
He broke his leg,
didn't he? Yeah.
Oh, I mean, you watch it and think, ow.
Yeah.
It's a tremendous fall.
It is,
Because when he falls through that parasol,
it
doesn't break his fall.
No.
He doesn't lose any momentum or speed. He just goes straight through it and straight into the ground.
You can feel it, can't you? You can feel it on the bloody concrete or
whatever. And you can see he's trying to keep the weight off of one foot.
Yeah.
And there's publicity photos where he's getting exterminated and you can see his cast poking out and stuff. All the stuff of Robomen falling off of high places and the explosions are great.
Yeah.
I love the bit where the Daleks get magnetised and it crunches down
into
the floor.
Yeah, that's really cool. Yeah.
It's a bit... I mean, I was never really sure what was going on when I was a kid that was due to the magnetic pull. I know it's really obviously spelt out, but I wasn't a very bright kid. I'm very bright now. But I think that effect would be sold much better if it was obvious that it was getting pulled, or if they all just went
crunched
crunched down.
Yeah.
That would look cool.
That would look cool. Is that how they get defeated in the TV version?
I can't remember how they get defeated in the TV version.
No, not me.
Do they just explode the bomb in... I mean, there's definitely something about the course of the bomb.
Yeah, the volcano goes off still.
Yeah.
Because you see it in the film version, but it's very...
In the background.
Yeah, it's not very clear at all.
There's just some explosions going off and it goes a bit red in the background. Yeah. That model bit is not great either.
No.
It's, you know, the flames are too scale.
Yeah, they're not to scale. And when the ship crashes into that tower, it sort of slows to hit it.
And you can see the wires in a lot of spots.
Yeah,
with the ship.
I'd never noticed that before. Yeah. That's the trouble with 4K and all that stuff. The better things you know, certain things aren't meant to be seen this way.
What, how do you feel about that? Because I saw The Spy Who Loved Me in the cinema about 2 or 3 weeks ago.
Yeah.
And I've always noticed when I've watched a Bond Blu-ray, certainly the Connery movies, I mean, he's plastered in makeup.
Yeah.
But you wouldn't have seen that on the Ultimate DVDs.
No.
But yeah, when you watch these old films in a higher resolution than they were intended to be, it does reveal the secrets of it, and it does make it look a little bit more, you know, ragged around the edges. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I mean...
Is the restoration there supposed to be just for the film or for like the context in the picture, you know? Would you have painted those out?
That's the trouble, isn't it? You know, part of me probably would have said, let's paint them out, but then...
Because I think that's less egregious than fixing the eye lines in Legopolis.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So if you can do that,
maybe
they could have afforded this the same treatment, but then that's not the film. That's not the film in its purest quality, is it?
I saw some clips the other day from Captain Scarlet in Blu-ray, because I used to like Captain Scarlet.
God, yeah, how are they going to...
And the wires were just so obvious. Yeah. I mean, I know that was always a thing, like, oh, you can see the wires.
Yeah.
But now it was like, you can really see the wires.
It's just wires.
Yeah.
You can't not just stare at the
wires. Yeah, and I was like, oh, that's a shame, you know. Mm. Although everything else looks amazing and seeing all these models and stuff in HD is fantastic, that does come with a price.
Mm. Yeah, I felt the same about when they did the DVD of Invasion Earth. That was the first time they kind of put extra special effects onto it.
Yeah.
And I think for something of a certain age, it should be left alone.
Mm.
But when it's laser effects and added bits like that, I think you can go to town on it. Mm. But when you start removing wires, it loses its charm. It kind of loses its context design-wise and historically. Yeah. So I would tend not to touch that stuff.
It's very difficult.
Mm.
It's a real, real hard debate, but...
Yeah. Ayop. Anyway, there's the Dalek movies for you.
Yeah.
Are we more in a Barbara camp or a Louise camp?
Louise.
You prefer Louise?
Yeah.
Yeah? And how good is Roberta Tovey in those films,
She's
by the way?
She's fantastic.
For a child actor.
Yeah.
I hadn't appreciated how young she actually is in those, especially in the second one.
Yeah.
I think there's only a year gone.
Yeah, it's only a year,
But God, she's still very young.
I'm shocked that she didn't go on. I mean, I don't think she went on to do more. I've never seen her in anything
apart
else.
Apart from her single, obviously.
Apart from her single, yeah.
And the Lost Radio play.
Oh, yes.
Mm, that's interesting.
Yeah.
I would love that to be recovered one day.
Yeah, that'd be amazing.
That or an odd orphan episode from Dalek's Master Plan.
Oh, Master Plan.
One of the shit boring long ones that doesn't really go anywhere.
Yeah, because it's proper Doctor Who, isn't it?
You've got to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. There we go. Mm. Dalek movies.
Good fun. Go buy them on Blu-ray 4K.
Yeah.
Now.
I mean, and hopefully you got a telly big enough to fully enjoy it.
Yeah, that's it. I said this to Johnny in the cinema. I was like, you know, we can't really appreciate it because we don't have anything to play 4K and we don't have a 4K telly. So
there you go.
It's a bit of a shame, but
so maybe just buy the Blu-ray.
Enjoy
that. Yeah.
The Johnny's commentary was very good during that film, especially during the scene with the soup in
Invasion Earth.
Yeah. Because he turned around to me and said, Nana used to have bowls exactly like those. He said, and every time she served soup in them, it used to make me think of this scene. And other things of that nature that just made me crack up and just think, what is going on?
I know, okay, I know we felt like we were going to move on from
the movie then,
but I think that has more iconic moments, that second movie. So that whole bit, with the old ladies in the shack and the Daleks turning up.
Yeah.
When Philip Maddock gets killed by the Daleks and double-crossed by them, that's really cool.
Yeah.
I can't really think. Is there any other big standout moments?
Oh, when the truck smashes through the Daleks.
Oh, of course. Yeah. Massive. Yeah. That's huge.
The explosions are good. Like, the explosion of the van's really good. The explosion of the shed is ridiculous.
It is massive.
What were they keeping in that shed? Making drums and gasoline or what?
I think that's when you think, oh, maybe bring in a big Dalek with a big gun and do a laser effect.
Yeah.
Because when it's the CO2 and then it erupts into this huge explosion, it's a bit like, all right, come on, just do the flames now.
Philip Maddock was great.
He's really good.
He's so good. He's such a dick.
When he kicks over that can of food.
Yeah.
So unnecessary.
Like, oh, that smells good. Trezum.
I bet he didn't have any of it. And he just set that whole thing up for them. And it's like, right, well, let's get walking.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
There was that funny bit, everyone laughed, where he was like, oh, I think I can help you with that. And then it was just a close-up of him smoking.
There were less laughs in the second one.
There were, weren't there?
And I felt like, part of me was like, maybe people are watching it and going, I mean, actually, this is a better film.
Mm.
And they're just watching it like more of a movie.
Yeah.
But yeah, there are less unintentional moments of comedy.
Yeah.
The Daleks aren't as funny.
No.
And I know the Daleks aren't intentionally funny in that first one, but when Barbara, Dalek, yes.
Oh, that's
help me,
I
help me.
That that's so
great.
Good. That's so good. And the robot, no one really laughed at the intentionally funny stuff, like the Roboman bit with Tom eating the stuff.
Is it sacrilege to say I think that scene goes on far too long and shouldn't be in the film?
Wow, really? Because Johnny loves that scene.
It's like, well, we've got Bernard Cribbins and he does comedy well. Should we get him to do a little comedy dance turn?
Yeah.
Because it's the music.
Oh, the music.
I know it uses so motifs from the Roboman's theme and the Daleks theme and blah, blah, blah. But it's like something out of a fucking Carry On movie. It's just so
Carry
out of place.
Carry On.
It comes out of absolutely nowhere.
Oh, it's good fun though. Oh. I think it needs it. Otherwise it would just be so depressing a film. There's not really much levity up until that point.
That's fine. But when it starts getting into and it's like, you've just done like a whole bloody routine already.
I think what we should have done is we should have learnt the choreography for that.
Yeah.
And we should have started this off, this episode, with us marching in.
We just need more people.
We need more people.
In gimp suits.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's plenty in this office.
There probably is plenty in this. Yeah. The Roboman did make me laugh in this film.
Yeah.
Because they are of all shapes and sizes.
Yeah, and
I mean, obviously that is,
And their things are always wonky.
Never fit their heads.
I noticed for the first time, it's just a bike helmet with some sunglasses glued on the inside, some aviators glued on the inside.
Yeah.
And when he opens the transistor radio and goes, very technical.
Yeah,
and it's just a load of like brown motherboard circuit boards and resistors, and everyone pissed themselves in the cinema.
Oh, it is. I mean, it's a shame because the poster makes the Roboman look so menacing.
Yeah.
Because it is a great design.
It is a great design. They're guns.
Yeah.
Now, did you see what they do when they fire them?
They light up, don't they?
There's like a tube.
Right.
On the inside that's like full of water or something. And
right.
It like bubbles and it like creates this like strobing effect.
Wow.
And when you go into the Dalek control room, on the wall below the rail counter, there's like four of these lines. They look like sort of halogen light tubes.
Yeah.
But I think they're repurposed from the Roboman guns.
Right.
And they just kind of blip and bibble.
That's
and
cool.
There's like a white light on the inside. But
watch it.
When I think it's when Wyler is kind of like on the ground and he thinks he's going to get shot.
Yeah.
And then he chucks the brick at the Roboman's head.
Yes.
If you look at his gun,
you
can see that strobing effect on the inside.
Yeah, that's cool.
But that's what the 4K brings out in the image. And you think, you know, okay, the Daleks look crap.
Yeah.
You know, or not well looked after.
Yeah.
For a lot of it. But those little moments, they're lovely little things you wouldn't have noticed otherwise.
Yeah. Now, talking about the Daleks, so Jonathan is potentially getting a Hartnell-era full-size Dalek, which now means that I cannot own a Hartnell-era full-size Dalek, which is the Dalek that I would have liked to have owned. But
I would have thought you'd gone for more like the evil Solar Slat.
Oh, yeah, but that's the one that he wants. He wants
Master
Plan one. Master Plan one, and that was the one that I would want. So then I was like, well, if I was to get another full-size Dalek, what would I go for? And I thought, well, it would probably have to be something from the films.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, that is a space issue of greater proportions. But the question is, which, if you could have a full-size Dalek from those films, which one would you go for?
The blue scientist.
Just the blue...
Undoubtedly, from the first one.
Just the blue...
Undoubtedly.
Just the normal blue one.
It just looks so cool.
Yeah.
And I like Daleks with different coloured domes. Like Daleks that have odd colourings.
Yeah.
We were talking about this before. With Matt's Dalek, I don't know if anybody's seen Dalek Derek, who's like a Destiny-style one.
Yeah.
We've been talking about maybe doing it up. Matt's going to do it up. And we were looking at kind of odd liveries, so not stuff that you'd see in the TV series, stuff from the comics and the big finishes and stuff. But what if you did a movie Dalek with a blue dome and stuff with that with Derek? That would look cool.
That would look cool.
What would you get?
I would get a blue one from the first film. Mm. I think it would either be that or the red one.
The red one, the lieutenant.
The red one is pretty nice looking.
It is nice.
Yeah.
And the commander's great with the alternating black and gold the spots.
Bloody bumps are stuck on all over the
place. I know, they're all
on the back.
I'm sure Dalek 6389's got eight.
There's a Terry Nation's Army episode waiting to happen. Misaligned bumps.
I haven't watched the one about the
Blowtorch. And then I noticed that in the thumbnail it has the correct the blue neck struts in the actual film, and I didn't notice that on Twitter when I was flicking through.
I'm sure there's at least like a 10 or 15 minute segment of that video that's just taken up with the colour of the neck ring.
Yeah,
which I look forward to watching.
I know. He's based around the corner, isn't he, Gav?
Is he?
I think so. Is he based in Bath?
Maybe we need to get Gav Reimel on.
I would love to talk to Gav about Daleks.
Let's do that.
And Cybermen and all that stuff and his 3D modelling work.
Plenty of chats we can have there.
Yeah.
Love
just
it.
Being sad.
Bunch of sad nerds get together and talk about sad nerd things.
Great.
Welcome to the review of Daleks.
Yes.
Love it.
Folks, welcome to Dungeons and Randomness. Since 2012, myself and an amazing cast of 18 have been telling stories in our homebrew world of Theria. Four different groups explore lost ruins, run for political office, rage against a mad king, set sail to long-forgotten islands, and so much more. Every group has a different story and flavor, and every season, or arc, has a new set of groups and stories, all building the history of our world with every single session. Literally hundreds of hours of stories are waiting for you as part of the Pickaxe Network. Check out Dungeons and Randomness wherever you get your podcasts. And we'll see you around the table.
If you can see some names scrolling across the bottom of the screen, you can add your name to those names scrolling across the bottom of the screen by becoming a Patreon supporter on Patreon. You can find the links in the description to that down below. Oh, that's a particularly nice name going across the screen there. Mm. There you go.
So yeah, Curse of Peladon.
Curse of Peladon.
Why are we reviewing Curse of Peladon
because
today?
It's my birthday week and goddammit, it's my favourite Doctor Who story of all time, and I was worried that that would get challenged watching it over the last couple of days,
really?
But it absolutely hasn't.
Yeah.
I still think it's one of the best Doctor Who stories ever made.
It is. I mean, I actually, this was the second time I've watched it in as many weeks because my nephew watched it.
Yeah. Have we talked about their discovery of Doctor Who yet?
No, I don't think we have actually.
So your nephew's...
Yeah,
haven't watched an awful lot of Doctor Who prior to the last month or two.
No, they've not been allowed to watch Doctor Who.
I was trying not to say that.
Yeah. Oh, I don't care. I don't care. They've got a mad mother, but they've not been allowed to watch Doctor Who. So one is 8 and one is 6.
Think about starving kids of 6 and 8 Doctor Who.
I know.
It's terrible.
It was me. I was the one who was like, "Come on, they're old enough to be watching this stuff." And I just came down one day and said, "We're watching Doctor Who and the Sea Devils, and you're going to like it." The eldest was very excited.
Yeah.
Because I think for him, it's got this mystique of like forbidden fruit, you know, or we shouldn't really be watching this.
Yeah, I bet.
This has been the thing that we've been told we're not allowed to watch because it's too scary. Mm. And he is just obsessed with it now.
I love it.
He is like... he's just retaining story titles to memory.
But you do at that age.
And you do.
And he'll probably be writing it down in a book and trying to get the orders right and stuff,
I've given him the Doctor Who The Legend Continues book, so he's just been going through. Is this a good story? Is that a bad story? Underwater Menace, is this a good story? No, it's shit. I want to watch The Underwater Menace. No, you don't. What about Time Lash? Certainly not.
Absolutely not. You're not teaching them very well.
No.
But this would be a really interesting like side thing for the review of Death. Is like we have got a scientific experiment here.
Yeah.
We're growing our own Doctor Who fans.
We are, yeah.
We're growing the next generation of review of Death.
And this is it. And the other day, Emilio said something about, "Oh, I'd like to watch one of the new Doctors." Because so far he's only watched classic Doctor Who because of who his... father and uncle at
Right, of course.
And I was like, yeah, sure, let's go for it. Yeah, we're loonies. I said, let's go for it. Let's watch one. And Jonathan was like, ah, I don't show them that new stuff yet. And I said, oh, no, you should show them a bit of stuff. So I think we will try and...
I think the empty child's gotten Johnny in a bit of trouble,
The empty child got him into trouble. He hasn't watched the empty child.
No.
He just saw a picture of it in the book and then asked what this was about. And I told him. And he had nightmares.
Brilliant.
Fantastic. I mean, not for Jonathan. And
we've done a lot of, thank God, children are still terrified of Doctor Who and are getting mentally scarred by it. But that's why we're doing a podcast at our ages. I'm turning 26. You're 30 years old. And, you know, it's just what we do now. We're emotionally scarred by this TV series.
I mean, Jonathan turned around, Jonathan turned around to you yesterday and was like, God, you're so young.
I know. You're so old.
You're so old, yeah.
So they watched Curse of Peladon.
They watched Curse of Peladon. It was because he wanted to watch an Ice Warrior story.
Yeah.
John Pertwee seems to be his favourite Doctor.
Mm-hmm.
He keeps saying that it's his favourite. He has watched more John Pertwee stories than any other Doctor.
Good.
So he likes John and he likes Cybermen stories.
Brilliant.
Doesn't seem so fussed about Daleks. Cybermen.
It's a shame there's not a perfect marriage there of Third Doctor and Cyberman action. Have they seen the Five Doctors?
They've seen the Five Doctors, yeah, they enjoyed that.
Have they asked for any repeat viewings yet? Is there one that they've gone, can we watch that again?
No, not yet. Emilio's mad. He's very keen to just... He watched a couple and he's like, right, let's just go back from the beginning and go all the way through. He said,
absolutely the wrong thing to do.
Yeah, he said, you will hate it. He said, those early ones, you will absolutely hate.
Yeah.
You'll be bored of Doctor Who. Two episodes into An Unearthly Child.
Definitely.
So we've said, look, we'll just cherry pick for now, and then as you get a bit older, then we can start doing stuff. He wants to see some Hartnell.
Yeah.
So I said, maybe we should show him The Rescue, because that's a nice tight two-parter.
Yeah, yeah.
Then Johnny was worried that Caquillion might frighten him. But
you'll be all right.
Yeah, well...
Caquillion isn't...
Well, you say that, but he's a bit of a babby ass, my nephew.
Okay,
so,
fine.
You know.
I mean, if they can get through most of the Third Doctor, I think you're all right with Caquillion.
Yeah, they've been all right. There's only really...
The Empty Child.
The Empty Child, which they didn't even watch.
No.
Oh, no, Johnny did show them the clip where where he puts his hand through the letterbox.
That's why they're mentally scarred. Don't show them the Dr. Constantine bit.
That's what he saw in the book. He saw the Aliens and Monsters, you know, the great, fantastic books from 2005 and 6. Yeah, brilliant. And that was it. He just saw the little screen grabs of it transforming. That was it.
Nightmares. Terrified a whole generation of kids, though. So
it did,
it's good to see it still having the same effect.
It does. Yeah, there you are, Stephen. You still got it.
Good job.
Yeah.
Only
time you're going to get that from Billy.
Well, I was just about to say, not if you've read the reviews of Time Traveler's Wife. He hasn't got it at the moment.
But yeah, that did really badly,
it hasn't been renewed for a second series. And I saw there was a lot of people saying... pointing out things in it, it's like, oh, well, Stephen Moffat's always been a male chauvinist and has always written in that kind of way. And lots of people leaping to his defence and so on.
Oh, right.
I don't think you can say that he's got a brilliant track record of writing for women.
Mm.
I don't know, would you call him a chauvinist? It's not really our place to say. But
no, it's difficult.
I think the conversations about him went on far too long and got far too personal and vitriolic. Even I will stand up for Stephen Moffat and say you shouldn't be talking about people like that.
Oh, really? It was that bad?
Oh, I mean, it was just like, you've got to separate the art from the artist.
Yeah.
And I understand there are certain traits in his writing that pop up every now and again that you think, but, you know, the guy has just had a TV series not get recommissioned.
Mm.
I'm sure he's fine financially and all, but there's no need to bloody... Lay it on
shit
thick.
In his
hat. Shit in his hat. Love it. Shit in his laptop and slam it shut. Somebody used to talk with that at school. Not literally to do it. It's just a turn of phrase.
Yeah, Bill, look at this.
Right. Anyway, Curse of Peladon. Something that isn't shit.
Yeah.
Something that is absolutely wonderful.
Yeah, so he liked it.
Yes, good.
He was a fan.
That's good to hear. When we were talking earlier about recreating Dapol things.
Yeah.
That whole opening thing.
Yeah.
TARDIS perched on the edge of the table and the Doctor and Joe or the Doctor and Mel climbing up the armchair.
Yeah.
Getting to the top.
Yeah.
And then cliffhanger. Yeah. There's Daleks up there. Oh!
We were really lucky. As kids, we had the sofas in the front room were sort of grey. And they were weird. I don't know what they were, what you described them as, but it looked like
Peladon chic.
Yeah, it looked like rocks, and like a quarry. Yeah. So every time I wanted to play Doctor Who, it was like I had my homemade quarry.
I love it.
It was so good. It was perfect.
The TARDIS was always landing in the sunflower patch in the corner of the garden. The one bit where we had greenery, it was always landing there. I've got so many bloody disposable film camera photos of all my Dapple figures laid out and stuff. Yeah. It's great. But yeah.
We all did it.
There's a certain quality to this in terms of how dark it is and the way it's lit. It's just dripping with atmosphere. And it just seared itself onto my head. The last part and a half.
Yeah.
For sure. Particularly, I have got such vivid memories of watching on tape over and over and over again. A UK Gold taping of it. And I think it's just, it's got everything.
Yeah.
It's got great monsters. It's got a great supporting cast in so much as the aliens and the setup with King Peladon and with all those surrounding characters is so convincing. It just sets the world up beautifully.
All the characters feel like three-dimensional characters. They all feel like they have a life outside of the story.
And that Peladon has a society and a way of working and a system. That I wrote down. Peladon is a real, living, breathing world.
Yeah.
Perfect setup for it and the story coming in the first 4 minutes.
Yeah.
When you've got Hepesh and Peladon and Torvis.
Yeah.
And they have that argument. They say, well, look, you know, the Galactic Federation are coming. Just spells out everything you need.
Yeah.
And I need stuff spelling out to me sometimes, but it just lays it out beautifully.
Yeah.
And then the Doctor and Joe arrive and they're plunged into this mystery.
Yeah.
And we've had enough of the world set up that when they come into it,
they're
finding out about it and obviously bluffing that they're the Earth delegates and all that sort of stuff. It's wonderful.
It's so good.
But it just sets itself out so well that there's no chance that you lose interest in the place, in the politics.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, it doesn't get politic heavy, but it does enough that there's commentary there and it's not shoehorned in. It doesn't feel like someone's trying to impart some message or some or some way of thinking. But there are certainly some smart lines in there. I think the way Alpha Centauri reacts to everything is like more of a comment on bureaucracy than most of the dialogue. It's just so well
told. It's really good. And you know, it allows itself to have those lovely quiet moments, like the scene with King Peladon and Hepesh, where he's talking about, oh, you know, when your father died, we put you on the throne, and I took your hand, and Torvis took your hand, and your mother, and all this sort of stuff. He's like, does that scene need to be in there? Probably not, but the fact that it is in there just really helps build that world and those characters. And it makes you feel something. It makes you think, well, actually, you know, you really feel something for his character.
Later on, when King Peladon, for the story's sake, to add the drama into it and for stuff to happen, when he keeps sort of going against the Doctor and Hepesh is on his side and he's constantly cajoling him.
Yeah.
That setup at the beginning, you know, he's been an aide to him since he was a baby.
Yeah.
It makes Peladon's decision-making not seem so out of whack, because he's obviously the good guy, and he's obviously being painted as the noble prince and Joe's flame.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'd never noticed before. He has his legs out the whole story.
What is going on beneath
his waistline? That whole the costume's doing something completely different to the rest of his outfit.
It is pretty bonkers. Whenever he stands up and you see he's got like thigh-high boots.
I know.
And then like a little skirt or something.
If I was Joe, I'd be going, I mean, this is all right, but you need to sort this out here.
Yeah.
Like, come on, man. Really.
You know, it's royalty on the top and then Rocky Horror Show at the bottom.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Joe Grant's going to go on a date with Captain Mike Yates.
You're barking at the wrong tree.
Who's he bloody fooling?
Yeah.
I mean, come on, really? unless he's going to take her to the quiet corner of a pub and tell her something in confidence. That's not a date, you know?
Well, it never happens again.
So maybe he's like, hey, look, you know, don't worry. I was just trying to get something off my chest, but it's fine. I figured it all out. The opening shots of Peladon and the design of it.
Superb.
The models look great. The TARDIS model looks really lovely. And then the interior, it all carries across.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel like the two parts of the production weren't talking to each other. The one thing I do get a little bit, I don't know what the word is, I find it an odd design choice, especially in the last part, is all the hidey holes and corridors. Mm. When they, I love the whole, you know, moving the, the flaming torches.
Yeah.
But when it's just a curtain.
Yeah.
And then in the last part, there's like a rock left by the side of the curtain. Like you don't need to prop this curtain open. Okay? You just kind of move it out of the way.
Well, I think there's a door behind it, isn't it?
There is a door behind it. But yeah. I just thought it's like, it does what look is that
like,
doing
it
there?
It does look like, yeah.
But and the fact that like, I just, the Ice Warriors have got their own room.
Yeah.
There's only one bed. Islia, you know, can you imagine him taking his helmet off after a long day and just
de-robing,
lying back, knock on the door, knock four times, Sorg. He comes in. Yeah, it's just, it everything works.
Yeah.
Everything about it works. You get Alpha Centauri out of this story.
Yeah, she's fantastic.
Is there a better side character alien in a Doctor Who story than Alpha Centauri?
Yeah, so good.
The fact that, you know, what, 30, 40 years later,
that
character can come back and everybody goes, oh my God! You know, and that's the highlight of a good Doctor Who story.
Well, that's it, isn't it? You know, this was a character that was described as a dick in a curtain, but that dick in a curtain had legs.
I've been looking at a lot of photos of that dick without the curtain on.
Oh, yeah.
And it looks like a dick without... It really, really looks
That curtain,
bad.
You know, solved a lot of problems.
It does.
It really does.
Stuart Fell.
Yeah.
Does so well. Like, the constantly kind of like moving and that lovely little bit at the end where they all put their hands up and vote.
Yeah.
And Sorg sort of turns into her and kind of freaks her out and puts the claw up. So cool. The production design is just on fire. The whole thing. Sorg.
Quite literally almost because of all those flaming torches.
I know. And everybody's hairspray. And
yeah, I do worry.
It's the 70s. There's a lot of polyester.
Yeah.
Everybody's costumes would melt to their skin if you got too close to those flames. Like, I love how the Galactic Federation, with all their bureaucracy, they keep pressing onto their timetable, even though there's something going on with murder and collusion in the monarchy of this civilized world. They keep, no, we've got to stick to time. Yeah. Like, the delegates arrived. You haven't got your papers, you'll do. There's no checking.
Yeah, no.
Which makes it so ridiculous at the end. You think, you've gone through all of this and just trusted they've lost their stuff in the crash.
Yeah, yeah.
Does Islia at any point see this shuttle
that
apparently this crashed down the mountain?
Yeah.
No.
And I love the bit in the beginning when it becomes apparent that something has gone on and the delegates are like, what? There's been a murder? What the hell? Apparently I was like, it's nothing. We're dealing with it.
I know.
It's fine. Sure. All right.
Sure. Okay, fine. And let's go out and get crushed by this giant stone statue.
Yeah.
At no point do they call any of it off.
Yeah.
But then when it gets to the end, you think, I mean, this really has escalated to the point they start talking about there's going to be intergalactic war.
Yeah, yeah.
And you think, actually, the building blocks and everything that's happened and unfolded, this kind of does make sense that it would unfold. Ice Warriors would start taking pot shots at blah, blah, blah. Mars doesn't get on with wherever Arcturus is from. We never find out where.
I think he is from Arcturus.
Arcturus. Yeah. The delegate from Arcturus. Are they all called Arcturus?
Yeah.
How do they differentiate between them?
It's just him. He's the one person on that planet.
He's a planet of one, nation of one.
But, I mean, I love all that stuff with the Ice Warriors, you know, that they very quickly set up the Doctor's distrust of them.
Mm.
And John does it very well.
Yeah.
But he's so good. What I love about John, and he gets to do it a lot in his era.
Mm.
He's very good at all that pomp and circumstance stuff
in
terms of, you know, the bowing and stuff. There's the bit where when they first come along and Hepesh bows and he bows in a particular way and then the Doctor follows suit.
Yeah, yeah.
And I love stuff like that because it's like, oh, this is a man who is he's a traveller. He's watching what's happening.
Mm.
And, oh, I will respect you by mimicking exactly what
and
you do.
He does it again with the Draconians.
And he does it with the Draconians.
I love all that stuff. Yeah, and then introducing, you know, Princess Josephine of TARDIS.
Yeah, yeah.
That seems like such a New Who thing to do, is reference the show in that way.
Yeah.
On the screen, you know.
And she's great. Katie Manning does that so well when she puts on her sort of posh voice and is like, oh, I'm, you know, kindly blah, 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 blah. And you're like, oh, this is so good. They're loving it.
All the stuff with her and King Peladon as well.
Yeah.
Is like, it's really touching.
Yeah.
It's really, you know. But then he's constantly.
I was going to say, you fucking bungle
her over.
He bungles it every time.
Every time, you say, you're so close, mate. But just every single time, you know, he's like, well, put in a good word for me. Fuck off.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, I really like, do you want to marry me for political gain?
Yeah.
What are you doing? It's being served to you on a plate, pretty much, mate. And you're constantly going like, no, I mean, it's not good enough for me. You're just going to have to do this extra thing. And like, you would have learnt the first time that Joe scorned him.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the fact that even at the end, when they have that nice little scene where he's like, well, you're going to stay on and marry me. And
yeah.
Isley is like, your forthcoming marriage.
And yeah, stuff. Yeah.
There's a bit in there where John says, well, you know, we're going to go off together, aren't we? And she says, well, I probably better had go now.
Yeah.
You think, well, she could have stayed. And you really feel that could have happened in the story.
She could have been Queen Peladon. God, Monster of Peladon would have
been
such
a whole different story.
Wow.
Monster of Peladon, I think, do you think it casts any reflective gloom on this one?
I think it does. It doesn't impact this one at all in terms of its reputation or its standing as a good story. It is obviously a lot weaker. Mm. It doesn't help that it's six episodes.
Oh my God!
You know,
I know.
It could have been I think it could have been a fine four-parter.
Yeah.
But it's got the curse of having to be the curse of Peladon. It's got the curse of being a six-parter.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's a shame. But I do appreciate Monster for how it builds, it grows the world out from what we've seen set up in this first story.
I was just going to say that. There's a bit where Hepesh says, da-da-da-da-da, he worries the Galactic Federation will corrupt Peladon with its technology and that they will be enslaved.
Yeah.
And that does happen by the time Monster and Peladon, so he's not wrong.
No.
So the Galactic Federation doesn't do an awful lot of good for Peladon by the time we come, because they're striking and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
I think that's when the political overtones get a bit
more
too
on the
heavy-handed.
Nose. Yeah.
Like, there's nice bits with Joe, you know, we want to raise them from savagery or whatever.
Yeah.
And Joe says maybe they don't want to be raised.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that's a nice little bit of commentary. But when the whole story centres around this allegory.
Yeah.
At least in Peladon in Curse, it's a wider narrative.
Yes.
But whether or not Peladon decide to join the Galactic Federation or the European
Union
doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
By the end of it, obviously, what happens happens, but it's not key to the plot that they actually do join.
Yeah.
Whereas the minus thing is just so central.
It is
to that
all
story,
about you know
to Monster.
Yeah. The uprising of the Badger Men.
Dudley Simpson reprises the drum motif for the Ice Warriors from the Seeds of Death.
Yeah, it's
which
a great
is
little theme.
Is a great little theme.
Yeah.
It seemed to me that this was directed a bit more like a 60s story.
Yeah, I know what you mean. It's directed well, though.
Lenny Mayne
does a really good job. There's some nice little bits. Mm. There's a really good bit. The reprise from episode 3 at the start of part 4 when Zorg turns around and blasts Arcturus and then Katie goes, Joe goes, oh, so it was Arcturus all along. And then it cuts to John, but they've now moved to the throne room. And he's like, yeah, that's a fabulous bit of directing.
And even the gunshot.
Yeah.
When you think, you know, always have to watch these things in context, which is why I'll just very quickly mention UK number one, I'd like to teach the world to sing in perfect harmony.
Oh, lovely.
And A Clockwork Orange had just come out in the UK.
Nice.
It just shows the disparity in culture.
Yeah.
You know, like Doctor Who, by comparison, is so light and fluffy.
Yeah.
You think of that compared to the music as well. Like, they're driving into, I mean, they're not listening to it on the radio because the BBC banned it, but like all these drug references in Beatles songs and Patrick Troughton's playing the Doctor.
Yeah,
and you
think,
those are two very different establishments and very different cultures happening alongside each other.
I mean, people will be saying the same of now.
Well,
you know,
true.
In 40 years' time, they'll be like, oh, wow, look at, I don't know, what's happening in the world. Well, there's bloody human rights bullshit going on in America.
Indeed.
And then...
you look at what's happening over here and
look at these two wankers chatting about because of Peladon.
That's why you're here, though. You love it. I've run out of steam on that one. There you go. What else have I got?
Alan Bennion as Islia is very good, isn't he? I mean, obviously, he's reprised the role from Seeds of Death.
Mm-hmm.
And then obviously comes back again in...
He's got more to do. He can play a goodie.
That's such a great idea. Brian Hales, man. You know, obviously, he penned all of the Ice Warrior stories for Classic Who. And wow, he was good. I think this is his best story.
I think it's his best script. I think, and also that it doesn't do that typical thing with Doctor Who at this time, where they land on a planet and they have to spend the first 3.5 episodes convincing everybody they're on the good side.
Yeah,
it's nice that in the hysteria that gets whipped up by all these people being murdered and all the collusion and stuff, that they just sort of become part of the narrative.
Yeah.
And it's only until later on when you need more drama because you're getting closer to the answer and you've forgotten all the events that happened prior. When they start to be distrustful of the Doctor and Joe and the Ice Warriors, you're like, that's where this part of the story can breathe. You don't need to front load it with all this, you know, misdirection and then mistrusting the Doctor and Joe.
Yeah, there's none of that, oh, right, put them in prison and all that kind of stuff.
And when it happens in part three, it's like, well, this is expanding it because Joe's, you know, when she's climbing around the edge and she's getting out of her prison cell and that kind of stuff.
That's all really good. All that stuff shot on film outside on the mountainside looks so good.
Really
and the fight scene as well with him and Gron.
Yes.
That's really great. And I believe that those film sequences do exist.
Now, I would, this is what I was talking to you about before. I noticed something really interesting watching that fight sequence.
Yeah.
And I'd be interested to see if we can get those full film sequences at some point. Because when Grun body slams the Doctor into the netting, it's just before the cliffhanger.
Yeah.
And just before the big log gets chucked.
Yeah.
You can hear Terry Walsh talking to Gordon St. Clair, who played Grun.
Right.
You can hear him going up, 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 up.
Oh, really?
Like as he's posting him up for the body slam, you can hear him going up, 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 like talking to him under his breath.
How weird.
And I'd never noticed it before.
Wow.
But I mean, I'm not sure that there's a lot of audio restoration on the BritBox version of it.
Yeah, yeah.
But I've never noticed it before. But I'm sure if you isolate that bit, you can hear him. He says something to him, and it's just it's repeated.
I'll have to go and look that up.
And given that Grun is mute.
Yeah.
You know, it's not him having a long, deep conversation, long, deep chat.
Yeah, that's a weird thing, isn't it, on Peladon, that the king's champion is always mute.
Yeah.
Why is that?
Because he's probably not a good enough actor to be fair dialogue. I mean, you're ropey when you're looking at him going, that's not a very convincing, you know. You could put a bit more dumbness into
it's a bit like,
if you want.
It's a bit like Lassie, isn't it? It's like, what, Grun?
What, Grun? You're going to kill me in that cave? Oh, okay, well, I'll come running then. Yeah.
But I do love that he's a bit of a gentle giant come the end. You know, he's scared of Agador.
But there's still, at the end, there's still, like, you know, he's getting scorned.
Mm.
But he doesn't have that kind of, oh, I'm sorry, King Peladon, sort of look on his face.
No.
You just think, he's too thick to grasp.
He doesn't really know what's going on.
No, wrong,
he's just,
you know,
he just follows orders and that's it.
He gets his gruel put in front of him.
Yeah.
And like
and he's happy.
Like a parrot in a cage, they just put something on his head and he goes to sleep and that's it.
He gets to beat the shit out of some people and that's what he's there for. That's what he likes doing.
I think that if I was to criticise anything, I think that fourth part feels pretty inconsequential.
Right.
But because by the you know, in the first 3 minutes, you know Arcturus is the main baddie and he's been offed. So you're just waiting for Hepesh to pop his head up again to get offed by Agador or to get put in jail. So all that stuff with the soldiers fighting amongst themselves and Hepesh's little resistance force and stuff, it feels a little bit like they're just kicking the story along until the end.
I guess it does. It's a good little fight sequence, though.
Yeah.
There's some really good... it's not Havoc, either.
It's not Havoc?
No, and I should have made a note of who it was, but I noticed on the credits it was somebody else. It was you know, fight choreography by some
interesting,
I guess, because it was all swords and stuff.
Yeah.
Perhaps it needed to be a specific type
of groups that came in to do it.
But it is really good. I was watching it, it was like, you know, God, people are getting stabbed, punched in the face. Great stuff.
Even Terry Walsh in his wig.
Yeah.
In some stories it's painfully obvious.
Yeah.
But I feel like John's back isn't as bad as it gets later on.
Yeah.
So he is still involved in enough of the fight up close and that you can convincingly think that's
I'll be honest, some of the stuff that John does do,
yeah.
I was really surprised he did do, because I was like, whoa, your back must be in bits.
When he rolls off the log, when the thing comes down, and when he's choking Grun and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
Violence in Doctor Who. Do we think that is, when he chokes him with the rope along the side of the... I know he lets him go.
Yeah.
But it's a bit hands-on for the Doctor, isn't it?
I guess it is a little bit. And actually, I'm glad you mentioned this, because we didn't talk about last time when we reviewed Attack of the Cybermen. The major thing, we never talked about Colin blasting the Cybermen.
We talked a little bit about the scene, but
did we?
Not...
I don't think we said, like, how do we feel about the Doctor just going gung-ho and just being like, boom, die.
I think it doesn't speak to a great understanding of the character on Eric Saywood's behalf.
Yeah.
But I suppose the problem is you've got a really dark story twinned with a pacifist character.
Yeah.
And when they're the only one that's left alive at the end of the story, what else are you going
to
do?
And you've got cyber leaders to the left of me, cyber fat controllers on
the right. Yeah.
Here I am.
Stuck in the middle with Perry. That's no problem at all. But it's just, yeah. I mean, in Earthshock, it feels more violent because it's point blank into his chest.
Yeah.
And the cyber leader takes ages to die.
Yeah. That's a good death.
It is a good death, even though his battery pack's come down.
So good.
But yeah, it's because they're bumping into each other and blasting each other. It's a bit like Vengeance on Varos. Like, whether or not the Doctor pushed them in the vat of acid is kind of moot.
Yeah.
Like, it's a life or death struggle.
Exactly.
And somebody's ended up dying in the struggle, and it's not the good guy. So that's kind of okay.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It's never really bothered me. No. I've always just thought, you know, well, he hasn't really got much choice in the matter. He'd blow up a Dalek.
Yeah.
You know, he'd put a bomb on a Dalek and blow it to smithereens.
And it's self-defense at the end of the day.
And it is self-defense,
I suppose maybe with the Cybermen it's different because they have got that element of humanity. Not that it's explored a lot in the classic series.
Yeah.
I think now, if the Doctor was to blast a Cyberman to bits.
Yeah.
I mean, apart from putting a telephone into the thing and their heads all exploding.
Yeah. Yes.
Especially coming off of a scene where one has just opened up about its life and he doesn't cry oil in that one.
I'm getting married in the morning or whatever it is.
Great.
Don't let Gareth see me. Yeah. I think you need more than a bell.
I think you will. He'll hear you coming down the chonk coming down the aisle going, what is going on?
I do.
Put on a bit of weight. I suppose because they've gone into detail about the fact that they are human, it feels a bit more visceral and like shocking in that story compared to Attack.
Yeah, but I guess they're even more like stompy robots, those new series ones. So there's visually, there feels like there'd be even more of a disconnect. Do you know what I mean?
What?
Like if you shot one.
Sure. Yeah, okay, I see what you mean. But the performances from the Cybermen are less robotic. I mean, not Michael Kilgareth beat Boop, but the performances are less mechanical.
Yeah, yeah.
That you get the inference that they're human underneath.
Yeah.
Without having to do David Banks going, my name is Sarah, you know.
Can you imagine?
At conventions, let's stop getting Colin Baker to perform Matt Smith's Pandorica speech.
Yeah.
Let's give David Banks.
Oh my God.
That scene.
Yes.
And get him to perform it.
The first person that does that. Oh, well, well done.
We'll send you all the Review of Death badges you want.
Yeah.
Couple of other notes. I love the shot of Arcturus loitering in the corridor outside his ear and Joe.
His hearing thing,
and then he just sort of wanders off down the corridor. Arcturus is a baddie. It's kind of like Scooby-Doo, isn't it? It's like, spot the villain in the room. Yeah. It's obviously him.
Yeah, he might as well have had a little twirly moustache and a cloak.
If he'd had arms to go, ah, you know.
Yeah.
I love Arcturus. When I was a kid, I always thought there was something quite Dalek-y about him. I think that's why I liked him.
But he's cool. It's a cool design. It's very sci-fi. Very. You know, you've got all the stuff in the tubes, all the liquid, all the smoke.
And the smoke and that, the
dripping
the dome.
Stuff. Yeah, he's cool.
That's really cool. The poor operator in there who was having to turn the head.
Yeah, I know. I was thinking that. I was like, God, that must be a cumbersome thing to get around. I bet he was thinking, give me a bloody Dalek.
Absolutely. That's far more comfortable than this. We love Agador.
Yeah, Agador. What do we think of Agador?
I think when you see photos of him in the rehearsal room, it looks like a teddy bear.
Yeah.
But when you see it in the show, it's lit so well and the caves are so good.
Do you think?
Apart from when the Doctor brings
him into the
court
throne room,
and it's hello, and he looks really cute,
and he's played by a little guy. You feel like he needs to be played by someone like Peter Mayhew, like Chewbacca size,
a monster.
Yeah,
because
the statues are humongous.
Yeah,
and you get this sense like, wow, this is a great thing.
But then,
just a baby one.
Yeah, maybe he's a baby Agador, but you know. Maybe that could be like a little commentary on Hepesh and him building up.
Yeah, true.
And actually, it's just a little thing from the forest.
Yeah.
And when,
like a Taran wood beast.
Exactly, except more convincing.
Yes.
And at the end, when it kind of gives the Doctor a cuddle and he's like, oh, it's growing quite attached to me and all that.
Yeah.
That's really lovely.
Yeah.
So we love Agador.
We love Agador.
And Venusian lullabies.
Yeah.
My mum, whenever she says, whenever I bring up Curse of Peladon, I start watching Curse of Peladon, she goes, oh, is that Harun, Harun, Harun?
Yeah.
Yes, it is Harun, Harun,
it
Harun.
Is. Akida Clack and Menenglack, Harun, Harun, Harun. Is that it?
Venusian lullaby.
Yeah.
He always sings alien things along to the tune of some old sailor's thing he learned in the Navy. It's great.
It's great. And I also love, there's a fantastic scene with John and Katie in part two, I think, where they go back to the room and the doctor's... Oh, he's looking at the bit of circuitry that's been left there that's to put the blame on the Ice Warriors. And, you know, she's like, oh, come on, you love all that delegate stuff. And he's like, well, how do you like being a princess?
Yeah.
And it is so lovely.
It's a lovely scene.
And you can see, he's like, oh, you can really see, like, as a kid, I didn't notice it. But, like, now, you can really see, yeah, God, he loves the bones.
Absolutely.
Of her, and vice versa.
I think that there's one bit in part four, I think it's in part four, maybe part three, when Joe scares off Agador with the flaming torch.
Yeah.
And he calls her an idiot.
Yeah.
And it's just... I don't know if, I mean, it's maybe me being a snowflake, but I just wish at the end of that he'd apologise for calling her an idiot, because he comes across a bit forceful. And then Joe says, well, I was only trying to help. And he goes, I know.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's get back to the others.
Yeah.
No sort of, sorry, fair enough.
Yeah. And there's a bit in The Demons, and I hate it, when he does the same thing in the pub, and she has a moan about the Brigadier.
Yeah.
And he's like, well, you know, he's still your commanding officer, so, you know, show some respect. And he really talks down to her. And I was like, no, that... I'm surprised neither of them said, oh, hang on a minute,
I can see why people don't like the Third Doctor, because there are a lot of moments like that where he does speak to people in a really authoritarian way, which is ironic considering he's supposed to hate authority and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But I think that's the fun thing of the duality in the Third Doctor is that he despises authority and yet he is a member of this... you know, intergalactic group of ticket inspectors.
Yeah, yeah.
Who at the end we find out are responsible for putting him on Peladon.
Yeah, yeah.
And also he works for this paramilitary organisation. So he kind of can't avoid that aspect in his life.
Being a Tory. Yeah.
But then he starts kind of reacting in that way and he starts becoming a bit, you know, authoritarian. And I get why people aren't fond of the Third Doctor for that reason.
Yeah.
But I guess... I can see through enough of
me
that
too.
And just enjoy him as the action hero.
Yeah. And then when he thinks that she might stay at the end, you can really see the worry in his face, like, oh God, I'm going to lose her.
Mm. And then it makes sense eventually that he just kind of grows into going, yeah, well, you kind of have to.
Yeah.
Maybe that was the first indication, like, she's going to meet somebody
one
day and then she's going to have to leave me. And
Also, the inside of the TARDIS... Man is looking grimy. It's like brown walls.
I mean,
have they been smoking Marlboro Lights in there or something? What is happening?
They've been hotboxing in the TARDIS. I think, obviously, the problem is they only need the TARDIS for that one scene.
Yeah.
And so they have as little of it in the corner of the studio as possible.
Yeah.
Is this the last time we see that photographic blow-up? Or is it in The Three Doctors?
I think it's the last time we see it.
Mm. And it's not in... I'm trying to think of other TARDIS scenes. It's not in Death to the Daleks.
No, I don't think so.
Obviously, Time Monster, you've got a completely new...
washing up bowls.
...design, and then in The Three Doctors, it's been
done up again.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm sure somebody out there will be able to tell us, is this the last time we see the photographic blow-ups?
I would say yes. I don't think you see it again in this season.
No.
And then, obviously, by which point, it's all done up anyway. So,
exactly.
Yeah.
I was going to say this earlier. The cliffhanger to part three, which you mentioned, when it whip pans over... On first viewing, on a tiny crap resolution screen, back in 1972, I think you can get away with not knowing that it was Sorg fired that shot.
Yeah.
Because the gun kind of looks similar to Arcturus's.
Yeah.
It's got the same red laser effect.
Yeah.
And the whip pan is fast enough that you can't really see that Sorg is carrying the gun.
Yeah.
So that's a really well-directed bit. Lenny Mayne obviously knows how quick that has to be to sell it.
Yeah,
that there's actual danger. So that's really nicely done. That's a really neat job. Well, those lights just go out then. Was that me?
I think it was you.
Oh, it was me. Me going mental.
Yeah, what are the cliffhangers in this story? Statue falling on their heads. What's episode two's cliffhanger?
Is it not the Doctor?
You must...
face drawn in combat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
To death.
And then Arcturus's laser.
Yeah.
That's probably the best cliffhanger.
It probably is. Yeah. obviously, Peladon gets a sequel, which we've already talked about, but why the hell have we not had a Peladon sequel in the new series? It feels like the most obvious thing to do.
And I feel like with Russell coming back and everything that's happened
going on
in between him leaving and now, there's definitely a story about Peladon seceding from the Galactic Federation and wanting out.
Yeah.
And the Doctor explaining why that's a really bad idea.
Yeah.
But you can have a Herpesh in government who's going, no, no, we'll be better off and everything will be fine and we can do this ourselves. And the Doctor's going, actually, you kind of you need cooperation among
species.
And maybe
like the royal family aren't really, you know, they're just like our royal family. They're just there.
Yeah.
They have no power anymore.
They use, you know, money that's supposed to go to help the poorest in their community to heat their throne room.
Yeah.
Because that doesn't happen in Earth terms, because that would be horrendous if somebody was to do that. The conflict is obviously, you know, you can expand on that massively, all these different nations and the bureaucracy and Alpha Centauri trying to be, hey, look, we're trying to keep our hands off. When she says, or he says, I want it noted that I have an argument and I don't want to put my hand up for this.
Yeah.
It's like such a bureaucratic thing to do.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, of course you've got to put that last little bit in. Just to say, if it goes tits up, nothing to do with me.
Yeah.
And Alpha Centauri is such a great kind of commentary on all that red tape and all that. Yeah. Fluffiness, you know.
Yeah, it seems mad, but they haven't done it. And I mean, I'm glad Big Finish have now done the Peladon box set. I've not listened to it, but
is it out?
It's out. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but David Troughton reprising his role as King Peladon, which is good fun. But yeah, it really does feel like Peladon is a planet that needs to be explored in the new series.
Can you think of many other worlds that are that, you know, considering it's appeared in two stories, is not, you know, a small amount to be revisiting another world. But are there any other planets that, you know, Varos, you feel like that story's being
that's
told.
Sort of done,
unless they come back to it and it's got even worse, or it's like a TikTok version of it. Yeah. Yeah. It's like
worse,
more of a comment on reality TV.
Men fighting in the nappies.
Of course you would. Or Sean Connery's son tied up to something. Sweating profusely. I can't really think of any other planets you want to go back to.
Yeah.
Marinus. But even then, take it or leave it.
Like all the big, I mean, like you've got the big ones like Skaro, Telos, which obviously they do go back to occasionally. Mm. But again, I think the Thals are worth a revisit.
Yeah.
We haven't heard from the Thals since 1974,
five. Raxacara Cofalibatorius, of course.
Well, they never went there though, did they?
But we haven't seen it.
We haven't seen it.
That seems a bit crazy.
Yeah.
Klon.
We haven't seen the planet of the Sontarans either.
We haven't seen Sontar.
Yeah.
Isn't that mad? Mm. We've seen all their ships.
Yeah.
We've seen how they feed and breed.
Yeah.
But we haven't seen their planet.
Yeah, it's bonkers, isn't it?
That's kind of odd.
I guess it'd be quite boring. It's just full of potato-headed men.
All shouting at each other.
Yeah.
You can see enough of that on TV.
Yeah.
Especially in the moment.
That was interesting. If you watched Fixed with Sontarans.
Yeah, they've edited somebody out of it and got Colin to do new lines.
Yeah, that was really cool.
I like that. We can add that as a new appearance, a new performance by Colin Baker. Yeah.
Is it canon?
That's canon. I think we can say that one's canon.
Yeah, that's a canon story, isn't
it? Well, because obviously the person appearing at the end relates it to another TV show, so it's obviously a skit.
But
now that that's removed for the right reasons, naturally, it does make it,
doesn't it,
canonical in my eyes.
Well, so there was a second Sontaran story with the Sixth Doctor.
With the Sixth Doctor.
Gareth Jenkins. I know that name is so kissable.
It's lush.
And he looks at his helmet's coming off, all the Velcro, and you think, oh shit.
It's horrendous.
How is it worse in 1986 or whenever it is compared to like 1974?
Well, I think, you know, from a lot of the stuff that's on that Blu-ray set, the documentaries and stuff, you really do realise. It's obviously always been a thing. Doctor Who never had enough money,
but
it's like
it really
you've still got like 1975 budgets, and it doesn't stretch that far anymore. It obviously wasn't getting the investment it needed, and Jonathan Powell and Michael Grade and all of those Floor Six people have all said that we just kind of let it fall into disrepair, and by that time that's when you start seeing it on screen. I mean, really, what, like sort of Graham Williams?
Oh, yeah,
that's when you start to see on screen that there's no money.
It looks rough.
Yeah.
Sunmakers looks appalling. Mm-hmm. And obviously Underworld is a total write-off. Yeah. But, oh, yeah.
And it just it starts to show in those. You kind of feel like with the Seventh Doctor era, they realize they've either got a bit more money.
Yeah.
They're shooting on videotape, which maybe saves a bit of money as well. But they're starting to realize how to spend their money and where to spend it. And obviously you've got fewer episodes and all that kind of stuff. So it's like they've, you know, right, how do we, let's clear the slate. You know, what do we really need to be spending money on?
Yes. Yeah. You
know? And I guess ultimately not spending 10 grand refurbishing the TARDIS console for it to be used so fleetingly throughout the era anyway.
Yeah.
It's like, well, that's why the Haemavors look so good. Mm. And that's why you get the Destroyer and all that kind of stuff.
Because the money's going on that
the
stuff.
Money's
where
being
it
spent
needs to be
on the,
spent.
On the right things.
Yeah.
Whereas, yeah, like, with a story like Curse of Peladon, the BBC are so good at period dramas anyway that anything you do set in that kind of realm is going to look great.
Yeah.
Even if David Trankton's got his legs out too much.
Yeah.
But then when you start having to get, well, what does a space station look like?
Well, that's
and you've
it,
got designers with no money and they're like, well, I don't know, what does a space station look like on 30p?
But I can do a medieval throne room because, oh, we've got this chair, we've got these furs, we've got these curtains, we've got, you know. But I mean, it's still really well done. Like the insignia with like
Agador's face is all over the place.
There's a fantastic shot in episode 2 where Hepesh is doing all the stuff in the high priest's place. And the camera is shooting through the grating and it's like Agador's face. And then it slowly goes in. So like you go past the grating. It's a great shot. Lenny Mayne was a fantastic director.
And it all seems so well rehearsed.
Yeah.
Like the camera's shooting over David Trankton's shoulder. And then you get the close-ups as John walks into the room and all that sort of stuff. It's so beautifully staged.
Yeah.
It feels more like a period drama in those long sequences with like, you know, when you see something in a BBC documentary about shows made at the time or he was Colin Baker before he became Doctor Who.
Yeah.
And it's always a period drama and there's never any music.
Yeah.
And it's always a two-hander.
Yeah.
And so when you see King Peladon and Joe in those situations, you're like, well, this is everybody firing on all cylinders.
Yeah.
And it's a great story in that unit family era.
Yeah.
That's disassociated from all of that, and it's just a great standalone adventure.
It feels like a proper drama in those moments.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden a dick in a curtain walks in.
And then everybody goes, yeah! Alpha Centauri! And having the Ice Warriors there as well, it's like it lends it, like, it is a Doctor Who story, by the way.
Yeah.
You know the way the new series will do that sometimes.
Yeah.
Or, you know, there'll be a reference or there'll be a callback or something. You know, no matter where they are, no matter how regal it looks or whatever, there's always something in there just to remind you this is a daft thing. So here's the massive ice lizards wandering in with their big guns going.
Yeah.
And the fact that Sorg's mouth never opens.
Yeah.
Sunny Caldina. Is Sunny Caldina's doing the voice?
I don't know. RIP. I don't know. I kind of think he isn't.
Mm. So who's the voice of the Ice Warriors off screen?
I don't know. I mean, maybe it is him. He certainly does it in Monstro Peladon because he's got his accent.
Yeah. And then so that's Curse of Peladon.
How old would you have been when you first watched the story?
It would have been one of my first Johns that I watched that wasn't like Day of the Daleks.
I don't know why that made me laugh.
My first John.
Yeah.
Do you remember your first John?
It was probably Death of the Daleks.
Yeah.
But we had this was one of the first. We had both of these on video, on proper.
So Death release. Would have been my first John.
Yeah.
But out of the kind of UK gold tapings, it would have been this or the Sea Devils that I would have seen first.
Yeah.
But this one I always went back to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I had a friend when I was which is surprising. I had a friend when I was at secondary school. I went round his house, and he had some videos. And amongst his videos, he had a copy of The Curse of Peladon. And he didn't like Doctor Who or know anything about Doctor Who. I was like, "Holy shit, you've got a Doctor Who video!" And he's like, "Oh yeah, do you want it?" I was like, "Well, no, I've already got it, but." It's a really good story. It's do you want to watch it? It's like, no, that's fine. But, you know, have you watched it? Well, maybe, I don't know. And it's like, shame, you're missing out.
You are missing out. If you haven't seen The Curse of Peladon before, I know these days the Third Doctor's era, I think John ranks quite low, I think, amongst kind of more modern fans.
Why? What is wrong with them?
I don't know. I don't see a lot of love for the third Doctor. I see a lot of love for John.
Is it because people think he's just too Tory or something?
I think people think he's too authoritarian, and I think people think he's too...
Freaking kicks ass.
He does kick ass. But I do... I understand where that criticism comes from, but I think just liking that Doctor so much, I don't really... It doesn't... taint my experience watching it.
He's brilliant. He's up there for me.
Absolutely.
He's my second favourite.
So. Always been a favourite of mine. So yeah. If you haven't seen The Curse of Peladon, definitely check it out. It is so worth watching.
Do we normally have this foliage on the table?
No, it's been here the whole time. I quite like it.
Yeah, I like it too.
And with that, if you have any ideas on how we can improve the foliage in our set, please let us know in the comments down below.
Yeah.
And next time, what are we going to be talking about, Matt?
I don't know because I can't remember what the... thing is,
well, everybody's going a bit crazy over 2008 Doctor Who at the moment.
Oh yeah!
So we thought we'd have a look back at that classic, well-loved Series 4 story, Journey, I mean, the Doctor's Daughter.
Yes, and actually it's funny you should say that, because someone posted a scene from that, and I didn't watch it, because I thought, no, I'm watching it soon.
Yeah.
And they said, oh, I think this story needs to be re-evaluated. Yeah, and I thought, well...
If we can remember what that scene was...
I remember what the scene was. Oh, fuck me, I'm just kicking out the set. So, Doctor's Daughter. When was the last time you watched that?
It would have been 2008.
Was it really?
I didn't collect many of the DVDs after series... I think series 3 was the last box set I bought. And I didn't own the series 1 or 2 box set. And then I got a couple of the vanilla releases for series 4.
Right.
Didn't get anything for series 5.
No, not me.
Somehow I've got the series 6 box set because it was reduced to HMV, but I've never watched any of the discs on it.
Never dared put a disc in.
No, not from series 6. No, I'll catch fire. So The Doctor's Daughter.
Yeah.
Find your Blu-rays, get it on, and maybe, just maybe, by the time we see you next, there'll be some more Doctor Who news.
Yeah, it's been really quiet. So.
It has, but we know they're filming. We know they're out there. We know they're doing things and it's exciting.
It is exciting.
So it's only a matter of time before a monster gets leaked onto Twitter.
Yeah.
And we see the return of Frobisher in the show.
That'd be good, wouldn't it?
That'd be great.
He needs to come back. All right. Well, thank you all for listening, watching, and whatever else you've been doing to experience this podcast. And we'll see you next time. Hackley da clack and men in black. Naru, naru, naru.